This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
Well, my name is Scott Arnold, and are we good? Okay, perfect. My name is Scott Arnold, and I'll be leading our seminar today. So if you're looking to hear a seminar on working with at-risk kids, you're in the right place. If you're not, then try not to disrupt too much. So why don't we pray and get us started. Lord, thank you for a chance to be together, to think deeply about how to love people that may be a little different from us sometimes, but are still people that you love deeply. I pray that together we can learn and grow together and walk away from here with some ideas that will help us be more effective. We pray in your son's name. Amen. Come on in, guys. All right. I work with Youth for Christ in town, and so a lot of the work that I'm going to be referring to and talking to comes out of my own practical experience. I'm less of an egghead and more of a on-the-street kind of person. However, what I'd like to do this today in our seminar, I put version 2.0 on my opening screen because I did this seminar last year, and I've made some substantial changes to the seminar. For one reason, I didn't want to be boring and do the same thing 2 years in a row. But secondly, what I'd like to do today is I've kind of got our time broken down into two parts. And the first part is theory. And I want to get into some interesting theory that myself and some other folks have been working on, not from the perspective of a someone that's sitting in a library reading books about what it's about, but by pulling together people around the streets doing work with at-risk kids, both in urban contexts and in institutional contexts. And so what you're going to see today on the theory side, for the most part, is going to resonate with you, I hope, pretty deeply if you work with at-risk kids, but comes more from the practitioner side of modeling and less from the academic side. So, but I want to start out with just some basics. Let me pause. The second thing I want to do is get into some practicals, and one of the things I found last year is I spent a little too much time in theory and not enough in practical, so I'm going to try to shore that up a little this year. And to do that, I've cut out some of the interim matter, a lot of the notes and supporting materials I've cut down in order to be able to get some theory going and some practice going. So that's what we're going to be looking at today. Start out, why at-risk teens? This is a story of a young lady by the name of Jamie. This story was written by one of my staff people just about a month ago. She tells this story. She says, I have a deep concern for Jamie. She's quiet. You might miss her if you weren't looking for her. She accepted Christ last year on retreat and began bringing her younger sister with her to our club. Jamie suffers from depression and appears to have an eating disorder. She was held back in grade school and has a really low opinion of herself. She secretly cuts herself to release the pain and has battled this for some time. Participating in our family group sharing at club is especially difficult for her, yet she attends faithfully each week. I was thrilled when a girl in my discipleship group asked Jamie to join, and she agreed. Our weekly meetings consist of catching up, studying the Bible, and praying together. Jamie seemed overwhelmed at first, but slowly began to share her struggles with depression and suicidal thoughts. Last Monday, she missed club and admitted to a friend that she had cut herself again. While she's beginning to understand the depths of God's love and grace, it seems the more she grasps at these truths, the more thoughts of suicide and failure continue to flood her mind. Does this sound familiar to any kid you've worked with? Sadly, a friend of Jamie's died of a possible overdose or suicide this past weekend. This event triggered all of the struggles Jamie was having. In a desperate moment, she decided to take her own life. God was merciful, and her attempt was unsuccessful. Jamie later told me that while she was extremely high in the hospital, she kept asking why God would do this to her and allow so much pain in her life. I was able to explain to her how having a free will and living in a fallen world produce a lot of pain in everyone's life. And she was blown away as we explored Genesis and the fall of mankind. It was encouraging to see her begin to understand these truths for the first time. She's beginning to replace the negative thoughts with the fact that she's a child of God and that nothing can change that. The truths she's learning in discipleship are now a powerful influence, even in the midst of such a tragic attempt to deal with her pain. Sadly, this is a day-in and day-out story for a lot of young people. This story, or some permutation of it. Kids today, we were talking earlier, and one of the folks here commented that it seems like every kid's an at-risk kid anymore. And an argument could be made for that. But the pain of our young people is very poignant. And how we begin to engage the struggles and pain of some of the more broken in our society is a really important thing. I don't come to this seminar as if I know it all, because I don't. I've had some successes, and I've had some miserable failures. And if you work in this population very long, you'll have both. So I don't come as an expert, but I do come as someone that's been in the trenches for a while, and hopefully we can learn some things together that might help us touch these kids' lives. First of all, why should we be involved? Because God loves them. That's the single most important thing we've got to zone in on here. We should too. Those young people who are in at-risk situations and in life circumstances that are difficult are loved by God just as much as the clean-cut, have-it-together kind of kid that we can see on the cover of magazines or in the newspaper. Here we see in Deuteronomy 24, says, "Do not deprive the alien or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember, you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That's why I command you to do this." It's interesting how many of us, if we went back in our family tree, would find one of our ancestors that had some issues. Maybe you wouldn't have to go that far. Right? If you're like me. James 1, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after the orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. We don't use the word orphans nearly as much today as they have in the past, but it would be argued that a sizable portion of our population are orphans. Where's Daddy? Now, if you're working with at-risk populations, you'll know he's probably not home. And frequently, Mom isn't either. Luke 4, 18 and 19, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." This is the inaugural statement of Christ's ministry in the synagogue. Now, where's preach the gospel in there?
At the beginning.
But notice how much of the emphasis is on taking care of the pain and the suffering and the needs of those folks he's been sent to. He didn't stop at just preach the gospel. It's buried in there, but there's a whole lot of other things Jesus was sent to do. And the point that I'm trying to get at is God loves the poor and the needy in our society, and it's not enough to just go preach the gospel, and if we can't figure out how to work with them, let them just go be by themselves. We've got to address some of the real life issues that get into the lives of some of the kids that we love and care for. And so I want to start out by asking this question, what's an at-risk teen? We covered this a little last year, and for those of you who might have caught this seminar last year, we are, as I said, amending some of the material, but this is a little bit overlap. The definition I'm working from here, a youth whose environment or behaviors have a high correlation to substantially negative future life choices, which the community wishes to prevent, which is an interesting phrase. I think I commented on this last year, because that's how kids get categorized as at risk, is they're at risk to do something we don't want them to do. And interestingly enough, very few people are concerned about the things we don't want them to do that are damaging to their spiritual lives. Too often what falls into the category of at risk is just a kid who might damage himself or herself in a way that might cost us money. That's an unfortunate reality, but we want to look at it a little deeper than that. We want to look at, from as a biblical community, what are the things we're concerned about that this kid prevent himself from and move to a different level of functioning. This is a quick listing put together by a guy by the name of Dr. Scott Larson. He has a website that's referenced at the end of your packet. You don't need to write this down, and I'm not going to read through this because I've put it in your notes and handout, and I don't want to burn time. But these are some of the external factors that he's listed out, and this is, everybody has their own list. This is just one person's list. Scott's a believer. Actually used to work with Youth for Christ in the New England area and has launched his own ministry called Straight Ahead Ministries. Great website, great materials, a number of books. If you're looking for a great resource on working with especially institutionalized kids, he's a great resource. He also has what he calls personal factors, things that are going on inside the life of a kid. And again, you have that list in your handout. So these things taken together begin to give a shape and form to what we call an at-risk kid today. But what I really want to press into to start off with today is, what gospel do you bring to those kids? What gospel do you bring? What do I mean by that? Well, should it focus on the message of salvation? Anybody? Absolutely. You leave that out, go home. Too often, you see some of us, even in the faith community, try to get engaged in the life of a kid and leave the gospel out because we're thinking maybe the kid's not ready, or maybe they would be offended, or all the other things. And we look at all the life issues in a kid's life and we're worried, well, gosh, maybe I ought to be focused on this or that, or what are the gospel must be the central core thing we bring to a lost community. So I want to start out and say that, even though in some ways that's kind of obvious. But it's the first and foremost. However, the question arises, should it focus on social need? Should the gospel we bring in get into this issue of social need? Any thoughts? Yes. Yeah? Which ones? You ever thought about that?
They're specifically dealing with.
Okay, that they're specifically dealing with?
Love and acceptance.
Love and acceptance? Yeah. Okay, barriers to spiritual growth or to thriving? It's an interesting question, and it's a question that I didn't have an answer to when I first started my journey at working with urban kids. And this goes back about 15, 18 years ago now. I was asking that question, because I'll tell you one thing that I saw people that get involved with at-risk kids, be it urban or institutional or whatever, run into this whole myriad of issues and problems and needs. And what I observed is frequently they begin to build program after program after program to address all these needs, and those programs become the tail that starts to wag the dog. And you begin to ask the question, what's the point? And do we need all these programs? Are we really having an impact? And I didn't have any good answers to that. I started talking to some folks who are doing urban ministry and poking them pretty hard about, you know, why do you do this and why do you do that? And why don't you just leave it out? And why can't you just go and share the gospel and make disciples? And not very satisfied with some of the answers I got, so I decided this is what I'm going to do. I'm a bit of a knucklehead and kind of a maverick, so I decided I'm going to just work my butt off at sharing the gospel, discipling kids, and dealing with whatever came up that was an obstacle. And until I can't win at producing disciples, I'm going to stick with that plan. I'm not going to do any of that other stuff. I'm going to let somebody else do that. So that was my game plan. I had some conversation with the Urban Concern folks. They're like, oh, I don't think that's very smart. I'm like, yeah, that's my plan. So I had a long-running conversation with Swearingen for years on this. I got into all kinds of stuff. Anyway, so after a good eight-year run, it was time to cry uncle. All right. And I came to the conclusion that, no, I don't think it's possible to effectively raise disciples out of at-risk populations if you don't get into social needs. I'll give you one great practical example. If you got a kid that can't get a job and he needs money because he turned 17 and wants a car, or he got a job and needs a car, or he's got his girlfriend pregnant, or all, you know, he wants to bling, you name the list of reasons why a kid wants money. Every kid, when they reach that age, want money, right? What happens if they dropped out of school, have no job skills, aren't very disciplined, and look like a hood kid, and nobody will hire him? What are they going to do? Turn to crime. You ever considered how difficult it is to be a drug dealer and a walking disciple of Jesus at the same time? So the monetary need drives the behavior to access money that is familiar, resulting in a pull away from any capacity to walk with Christ at all. And there's a whole list of examples I could give you that we began to discover. Here's why we were losing kids, because as we got kids got older and older, we were losing them. And as we analyzed why we were losing them, that's what we kept coming up with. They were being driven out of our ministry by social needs that had gone unaddressed to a point where they pulled kids away from Christ. So that's my story. My story is I come to this topic as an unbeliever, if you will, in the need to engage social issues and rebuked from my own experience that, no, we need to be in this arena. So, being the knucklehead that I am, now that I decided that, now I want to go the other direction and say, so now what should I be in? What things should I be involved in? What is this holistic gospel? If I'm going to have an evangelical gospel, the four spiritual laws, and I'm going to have a social gospel, get involved in the social needs of kids, that frequently in literature and writing and conversation is referred to as the holistic gospel. What should that look like? What should I be concerned about? Because I'm still of the opinion that there is a gazillion things you can spend time and money on, and if you're familiar with business terms, there's a business term called opportunity cost, meaning you can't do two things at the same time. You can't fund two efforts at the same time. You got to do it one at a time. So if you're doing this, then you can't do that. So it's a pretty important question, is because there's so many things that you could do. And if you look out there's so many things going on that people are doing in an attempt to help kids. How do we know which ones? Well, that launched, in Scripture, a few more Scriptures that I think are important here. I'm convinced Scripture does support this notion, and you can find evidences of the need for us to be involved in some of these social efforts in a holistic gospel. Here in Ephesians 4:28 says, you're a thief, stop stealing, begin using your hands for honest work, and then give generously. So he's advocating work here as a part of our Christian life. That's something we should be doing. And that spoke very directly to some of the kids I'm working with. Okay? What about James? Dear brothers and sisters, what's the use of saying you have faith if you don't prove it by your actions? That kind of faith can't save anybody. Suppose you see a brother or sister who needs food and clothing and you say, well, goodbye and God bless you. Stay warm and eat well. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? Well, if you're dealing with people who have real food, they're hungry. Real clothing issues, they don't have clothes. And there are people like that. Not always because they couldn't access them. What I've seen more often than not is one example I can think of is a young man whose mom used up all of their money in the first 15 days of the month eating out at rallies. In the last 15 days of the month, they didn't have any money for food. So the last 15 days every month, they basically ate beans or rice for 15 days every month, month in, month out. Well, and she also spent a little bit on weed. Okay. So he was hungry all the time because all he had was a little bit of beans for the last 15 days of every month. You just bank on it. Okay. We have people like this. Our faith needs to be more robust to be addressing some of those issues. Here's a great story. I like this story because it addresses one of the areas that I'm driving towards. This is a story of the shrewd manager. Jesus told this story to his disciples. He says, a rich man hired a manager to handle his affairs, but soon a rumor went around. The manager was thoroughly dishonest. So his employer called him in and said, what's this I hear about you're stealing from me? Get your report in order because you're going to be dismissed. Well, the manager thought to himself, now what? I'm through here. Now what? I'm through here, and I don't have the strength to go out and dig ditches, and I'm too proud to beg. I know just the thing, and then I'll have plenty of friends to take care of me when I leave. So he invited each person who owed money to his employer to come and discuss the situation. He asked the first one, how much do you owe him? The man replied, I owe him 800 gallons of olive oil. So the manager told him, tear up that bill and write another one for 400 gallons. And how much do you owe my employer? He asked the next man. 1,000 bushels of wheat was the reply. Here, the manager said, take your bill and replace it with one for only 800 bushels. The rich man had to admire the dishonest rascal for being so shrewd. And it is true that the citizens of this world are more shrewd than the godly are. I tell you, use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. In this way, your generosity stores up a reward for you in heaven. Unless you're faithful in small matters, you won't be faithful in large ones. If you cheat even a little, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities. And if you are untrustworthy about worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches of heaven? And if you are not faithful with other people's money, why should you be trusted with money of your own? No one can serve two masters, for you will hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You can't serve both God and money. All right. He says, it's true the citizens of this world are more shrewd than the godly are. That's the phrase upon which this whole story turns. A lot of times people think it's a little confusing, but I really love this story. It's what's called an a fortiori argument. The idea is that this is true, but this is even more true on the strength of that. And a good example I came up with is, if your no-good, lazy brother-in-law pays his taxes, I don't understand why you don't pay yours. That's the strength of the argument. And so back in our passage, it's if the non-believers know how to make the most out of their money to make impact, why can't the believers be good stewards and shrewd like that? I tell you to use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. And if you're untrustworthy about worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches of heaven? He's making a case here that managing money is pretty important to our spiritual life. If you can't do it, you probably are going to be ineffective in some of your efforts to win other people to Christ, and you won't be given much by way of trust in managing or stewarding God's work. You ever thought about that? Economic management skills are a requirement to be an effective disciple. That's what he's saying there. This is Lady Ruby Payne. She's a teacher down in Texas, worked with at-risk kids and urban kids for a number of years. She says this, "A working definition of poverty is the extent to which an individual does without resources. These resources are the following: financial, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical, support systems, relationships, role models, and knowledge of hidden rules." Okay. Notice that she didn't say it was just a money problem. Well, if we're trying to impact a kid in the area of their spiritual lives and their physical lives and their mental lives and their emotional lives and their financial lives, it's a pretty robust effort. Pretty robust effort. All right. So holistic gospel is this effort to try to look through Scripture and say, what are the things Scriptures are saying is important that we ought to be involved in? And I've been working on this for a couple years now, and like I said, I've been working with a little task force of some other brothers that work in urban contexts, and we have developed an emerging model of what I call a holistic gospel model, and it looks something like this, and I'm driving towards this theory, and even though this feels like theory, and you probably came to hear about how to help the kid down the street, and what's this have to do with it, this is the foundation that if we can get a hold of, begins to spill down into all of the things that we do, and it gives us a model to decide what we do and what we don't do with kids that we're working with. Holistic gospel model. These are the six areas I believe are critical to be effective with at-risk kids. You'll notice the largest circle that goes around the outside is called the relational context. And it's the largest circle because I believe, and research bears out, the number one problem that young people have when they're in an at-risk situation is relational. And the number one thing that we as adults tend to do is chase all the other things. And so if you walked home from this seminar and didn't hear anything else, walk home, and I'm going to repeat this two or three times through this seminar, it's relationship. That's more important than poverty, single parents, in jail, not in jail, dropping out of school, behind that. All of that doesn't stack up to the impact of broken relationships in the lives of at-risk kids. That is the number one thing. And if you get your eye off that ball, you lost. All the rest of the stuff comes out of that. But that's the foundation. It's relationship with God. It's relationship with others. And we're going to break that down a little bit as we plow through this model. But that is the cornerstone of being effective with at-risk kids. Now, you might say, well, that's the cornerstone of being effective with anybody. Right. But the deficit in relationship with at-risk kids is huge. And so you think about the people you work with, people you disciple, your own life, and think about how bad relationships have negatively affected your life, and then multiply how bad your worst bad relational situation is by about 10, and that's the situation of a lot of kids you're working with. This is the deal. You could walk out of here right now, and you know, that's the thing. The rest of the stuff builds off that, but that is the thing. I can't say that enough. Beyond that, spiritual and moral literacy. This is the truth of the word, discipleship, evangelism, all the things that we impart to kids in the area of spiritual and moral understanding. Economic literacy, I think I've already made the case for that. Educational success. You can't thrive in our environment, our economy, and our world today if you're a high school dropout very well. And there's a reason why Christian missionaries started schools all across America. Because education is correlated with effectiveness at understanding the truths of God, communicating them effectively, and causing the gospel to move forward. When you have kids that are not succeeding educationally, we ought to be concerned about that as the church. That should be part of the impact we're making on a community. And when in Columbus Public Schools, they move from 4 out of 28 to 5 out of 28 successfully completed outcomes for the kids in that system, we ought to be crying tragedy, and the church ought to be concerned about that. And there may be different approaches to how we deal with that, but for us to turn a blind eye to education and the horrible educational system a lot of our kids in the city schools are in, and just say, well, as long as we send gospel tracts and we put Christian music on the radio, that I guess that's covering it. No, it's not. We're not taking care of the kids in our community. That's a big one for me. Basic health and safety, this may seem obvious, but you know, whenever you get involved with an at-risk kid, or anybody for that matter, if they've got a basic health or safety issue, they're not listening to anything else you say, right? I'm being molested at home, and I'm sitting here in this stupid seminar where you're telling me how Jesus loves me, and you put a Bible, blah, 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 blah. Did you hear me? I said I'm being molested at home. That's what I'm thinking about the whole time you're talking. Now, I've been with kids that's going on, and they just tune out everything else. I mean, they can maybe regurgitate what you said, but it's not hitting because they're in so much pain about the other issues. Until you start getting into those issues, I've had kids with medical cards whose parents won't even take them down to the hospital to get major issues fixed. Got kids with I have one kid, even though this wasn't a big health crisis per se, but he had a little tab come off of his glasses, and he had that little steel stub that holds the tab drill a hole right through his nose, and his mom wouldn't even take him down like five blocks away to get a new thing on his glasses, and they had a medical card that would have covered it, so it didn't even cost her anything. Okay, so health and safety issues, when kids are unsafe and have major health issues, and you'll find that going on with at-risk kids, frequently with the kids that look like everything's fine, if you don't deal with those, it's really hard to make an impact on some of these other areas because they're riveted, their mind is riveted on their life issues and the tragedy they're going through, sometimes very quietly, and that's their focus. And lastly, civic literacy, which sounds a little cryptic. We live in a community, and most at-risk kids I know of do not know how to work within a community, within the systems of a community. They attempt to try to solve problems in their life and deal with issues in their life in kind of a vigilante kind of way because they're frustrated and they've almost given up on trying to work within a system. And so trying to teach them how to be effective at working within a community, to be part of it, to feel part of it, to understand how to engage it, I found to be a critical piece. And it may, like I said, it may sound a little cryptic, but we'll break it down a little bit in the handout I gave you. I'm drilling a little deeper on some of the issues I'm talking about there. Learning how to deal with anger in a public or community setting would be a great example of that. How many kids can't process anger issues or can't process conflict in a community setting? And that lands them in jail, lands them in prison, destroys their life. So how we understand how a community works is critical. So this is a model we've been working on, like I said, and I'll throw it against the wall and say, I believe that is a holistic gospel. And I think that creates the arenas of influence that we need to be concerned about if we're going and working with an at-risk kid or an at-risk population. So there's six areas of what I call proactive focus. I'm still not going to suggest that if you've got a kid that's got something outside of one of those, it's a barrier to his spiritual walk, you wouldn't want to get into it. What I'm suggesting, on the other hand, is these are areas we need to have our lenses, our radar on for. Is this kid failing economically? Is his family crushed economically? Is this kid have health issues or safety issues going on? We've got to be thinking about those arenas when we're working with these kind of kids. There's also, underneath this model, and you're going to see in the appendix to the handout I gave you, each of those areas we've now broken down into 5 to 7 outcomes or deliverables. When we want to go in and work with a kid, we're going to try to begin to measure and move kids up in 5 to 7 measurable areas in each one of those circles, which it's going to allow us to do a lot of different things a lot more effectively by having some specific things that we're targeting to impact kids' lives in. Okay, so 5 to 7 measurables under each of the 6 areas, so that gives us at the most about 42 different strategies for impacting an at-risk kid that we feel if we can impact him on all those 42, we've got a huge probability of helping that leverage that kid into a walking disciple for Christ as a lifelong process. Okay, well, that still seems like a lot though, right? That's a big thought. Here, for example, is the relational context line. I just picked one, I threw it against the wall. This is the biggest circle. Since I said that's the big one, that's one we ought to be concerned about. Across the top, what you'll see is, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 areas that we're measuring in the area of relationship, of the relational context of a young person or an at-risk person. Appropriate interpersonal transparency. Is this kid living a double life and being secret? Because if he is, what you're working with isn't what's really going on, and you're wasting your time. So you got to somehow draw that kid out and teach him how to be honest with you. Ability to trust. If you got a kid that doesn't trust people, and frankly, every kid you're working with, if it's an at-risk kid, they don't trust people, right? That's a given. They don't trust people. And that's a huge barrier to life change. You've got to teach them how to learn to trust people again. And we're going to talk about that at the end, some ideas on how to do that. The quality and quantity of peer relationships, family relationships, and other adult relationships, those are critical. Those are the three realms of relational impact in a kid's life. You know, there's a study out of the University of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and I think that was one of the slides I pulled. I might reference it later, but there's a study where they did like 35,000 middle school students, and they researched what correlations in that kid's life or what things correlated to delinquency. And they found a 72-73% correlation between the quality of their relationships and delinquency. And the three things they looked at is peer relationships, family relationships, and other adults. Okay? Crucial. I mean, that's a phenomenal correlation from a statistical point of view. It's just huge. And then lastly, values interpersonal communication or interpersonal community. They don't have a value for it. As long as you prop them up, they'll kind of keep going. And as soon as you're out of their life, they fall right back out of it. If community is the things that keeps us growing spiritually. And then we've broken this down into five levels. And what we're trying to do with our model is actually create something. We'll take this one for example. Values interpersonal community, if they're thriving, they consistently involved in relational community and actively reach out to include others. That's someone that's thriving in their understanding of community and value for it. If they're safe, they're consistently involved. If they're stable, they're occasionally involved. If they're vulnerable, they're reluctant to be involved. And if they're in crisis, they're unresponsive to invitations to be part of a relational community. So what we're trying to do here is create a multiple guess grid across the five or six outcomes here in that piece of our model. And again, our goal here is to build a way to assess our kids in the key areas of a holistic gospel. And we're building a measurement tool that goes along with this, pre-test, post-test kind of a thing. So this is some of the stuff that I've been working on in the area of a holistic gospel model, and I believe this is critical to understanding what we're targeting. If you don't know what you're shooting at, you're likely to either hit it or not hit it, as you will, right? You know, the whole story about, you know, the guy that goes and draws the red circles around the arrow on the fence. I hit it. So you shoot first and then draw the bullseye. Instead, what we've been working on is what should the bullseyes be? And like I said, what I showed you that one piece. You'll see in the back, we've broken down and we've got the columns set up at this point for all six of those areas in our holistic gospel model. And now, in the next 30 days, it's our goal to get all those fleshed in with practical things that you could look at and say, yeah, that's either true or not true. Objective measurements of a kid so you can kind of track where a kid's at. And that will be coming. And I realize that I don't have it to give to you, but I figured I'd at least give you what I have and say, think about these things. Because this, you'll see as we go further in our seminar here that this becomes really helpful information as we drive more towards practical. Okay? Yes.
Do you have a website where this stuff would become available?
Yeah, that's a great question. We'll probably hang it on our coyfc.org website. And I'd say probably. We certainly will. I'm a little horribly behind on my website, but when I get this done, I'll definitely have it on there. So. COYFC, Central Ohio Youth for Christ. All right. Also, what this model gives us is a natural guide to collaboration with secular agencies and other adults. You're working with at-risk kids. You're working with other agencies, right? You're working with POs. You're working with FCCS workers. You're working with, you know, the welfare agency. You're working with all the different people that are involved in those kids' lives. Do you know them? Do you know who they are? Do you know how they work? Do you know how those systems work? Because if you don't, your kids that you're trying to reach out to is living a whole other life that you know nothing about. And that's, again, a lot of where he's living at, because these are people who have control over his life. and can make decisions that dramatically and negatively affect your ability to impact that kid's life. So beginning to know and understand how you can work with these folks and partner with them is critical in reaching into the life of an at-risk kid. Almost to a person, they've got a PO or they've got a FCCS worker. You can just count on it. All right. Well, this model allows us to begin to decide how do we partner. And this is a second piece of the model. It's also in your handout. Again, we're still in the theory section, but as we go out to collaborate, what we're saying here is the church cannot delegate the relational context or spiritual and moral literacy away. Can't do it. Why? Because the secular world doesn't have any value for spiritual things, or if they do, they're inaccurate. And because ultimately, the key to effective relationships is unconditional love that only comes from the heart of a believer, as God puts it there. The secular world has nothing to really offer in the area of relational context either. And you know what? The kids know that. They know which people are in their life because they're getting paid to be in their life. It's a really interesting phenomenon. But they've been so burnt relationally, they think like that. Why? The first question a kid asks that you're getting involved with that's at risk is, why are you involved in my life? What's your angle? What are you after? What are you trying to get me to do? Those are the questions. And those questions will rumble around for years as they're trying to figure you out. And if you aren't motivated by the love of God, they'll sniff you out sooner or later. Okay? The church cannot give those away. We cannot partner them away. We cannot delegate them away. We must do those things. These things, however, we got a good partner, we could. The key, however, and this is what, if I could take the rest of the seminar and just talk about this, we as the church still need to be concerned that they're happening, and we need to be concerned that they're happening appropriately. We've delegated away educational success, and our school system's failing miserably. So are we coming along and saying it's a problem and we're going to get involved to fix that because we're concerned about our kids? That's what we should be doing as the church. But if we had an outstanding educational program in our city, then we could say, hey, you know, we don't have to do that. Matter of fact, there's a win in partnering with secular folks because we can be their friends, we can work together, we can build relational bridges, maybe share the gospel, maybe they'll join us as part of the church. Yeah.
You know, because I used to, before I worked with the recreation, I was a caseworker for FCCS. Mm-hmm. The challenge of the church, do you think, like, especially if you look at churches like this or other churches that have moved way out in the suburbs or what have you, how do they stay connected to the urban, youth and still effectively be used? Because I see, like, a lot of the people, especially where I'm at, any Christian-based groups are those ones that's actually in the city,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily churches or organizations that's outside the suburbs. You know,
absolutely. In our church, we have a number of house groups that do meet in the city. And so we're trying to bring the gospel to the city and incarnate it there. So that is happening. You're also correct in saying that many of the, there's other organizations that are trying to incarnate Christ in the city. One of the sad but true realities of inner-city churches, most of you may not know this, but most inner-city churches are commuter churches. So what he's saying is true. The people that attend those churches live in the burbs, but they come back because Great Aunt Bethel was a founding member and her plaque's there, and you know my grandpa sat here all those years, and I'm going to come to this church till I die. And that's why they're there. But frequently, they're not comfortable with folks in the neighborhood attending. So, yes. Being incarnated into the neighborhood is a crucial piece of this. So what I guess what I'm saying here is this model begins to help us frame up. We need to be concerned about all these things, but we don't have to do all these things. But we can't dismiss the responsibility as believers who value a holistic gospel to delegate it and not be concerned if it's being done effectively. We still need to keep tabs on how our community is doing if we're delegating these kind of things outward to other organizations with a kid that we're working with or a community we're working with. We got to be asking the question, how are they doing in these areas? Again, that's where it begins to flow down. Now, I've got a limited amount of time, so I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about these two things, and I'm going to drill further down into our model and say, now let's put some more practical wheels to this. We had multiple seminars. We could go into all of these, but the key is, does the work of collaborators impact the measurable outcomes that we're after in all these areas? Again, I believe if we are hitting on all these areas, we can significantly impact at-risk kids and move them towards being lifelong followers of Christ. We can do it. God's power is enough. And if we're willing to be obedient and we're willing to invest in these areas, we can make a difference in the most broken kids' lives. So I'm not at all convinced that these kids can't be reached, can't be discipled, and can't be influencers for the kingdom. Quite the contrary, I believe they can be, and I'm pretty emphatic about that. But it won't be done with simplistic efforts. They've got a lot of crap going on in their lives. We've got to be willing to mount up and strap it on and deal with the depth of some of their suffering if we want to make an impact. So, all right, so I'm going to drill down now on these two things, this relational context, the church's critical role. And the rest of our time is going to be spent on that. So the arenas of relational context and spiritual and moral literacy, that's what we can't delegate. That's what we got to be best in class at. Here's the study. I guess I did throw it in. Study of 37,000 7th through 12th grade adolescents, family connectedness, school connectedness, and family stress correctly predicted what they call quietly disturbed behaviors. They had another study that were not so quietly. little different percentages, but they were still in the 70s. So they're predicting delinquency, 71.8% of the time in girls and 71.2% of the time in boys, based on what they call family connectedness, school connectedness, and family stress. It's all relational stuff. Okay? So I'm back to the relational context. That's what the church needs to be concerned about. Here's something real interesting. The Commission on Children at Risk, a panel of leading children's doctors. These are all secular folks, by the way. Let's see. They don't say it, but I can't remember, but it was like Harvard Medical School, or it was Dartmouth Medical School was the lead agency on this. So these are not believers, all right? Here's what they had to say. Leading children's doctors, research scientists, and youth service professionals has issued a report to the nation about new strategies to reduce the current high numbers of U.S. children who are suffering from emotional and behavioral problems such as depression, anxiety, attention deficit, conduct disorders, and thoughts of suicide. Sounds like our girl we started seminar with, right? What do they say that this girl needs? The commission is basing its recommendations on recent scientific findings suggesting that children are biologically hardwired for close attachments to other people, duh, and for moral and spiritual meaning. Duh. That's what we just said the church ought to be about. Here's a bunch of secular pagans with a whole lot more credentials than I have and a whole lot more learning than I have saying that's what it is. Moral, meeting children's needs for close attachments and for moral spiritual meaning is the best way to ensure their healthy development, according to the commission's report. It's called Hardwired to Connect. Great piece of work. Okay. Now, in my work, I've discovered, and this is going to be some overlap from what I talked about last year in this seminar version 1.0. Key deficits, the way I understand it as I've grappled with it, as we try to invest in these kids' lives, what I've discovered are four or five key areas that they're running in substantial deficit in this area of spiritual and moral literacy and relationship that we can connect back to our scriptural understanding of how we do ministry. So let's talk about them. Love, trust, hope, knowledge of the truth, and what I call dominant culture, relational capital. Love, trust, hope, knowledge of the truth, and dominant culture, relational capital. And the way this works is, as I've worked with kids and as our team has worked with kids, what we see is the relational deficits, the lack of unconditional love in these kids' lives drives them to a place where they don't trust anybody. And when they don't trust anybody and they don't feel loved, they lose hope for their lives. And it begins to spiral downward. Okay? And their knowledge of the truth is relatively limited. They're frequently working off of what I would call antithetical truths, which would raise the opposite of what's really good up to be good. Greed is good, kind of a concept. You know, sexual promiscuity is good. Being a G, that's good. You know, doing the things that are the opposite of what will cause your life to grow are being raised up as the value in the society these kids are in. Okay? So their knowledge of the truth is very limited. They don't even know why God would not want them to have sex before marriage. They wouldn't know. Their parents think it's a good thing. I know kids that have had, I've had one girl, her dad was encouraging her boyfriend when she was 15 to move in and live in her bedroom with her. Well, it was a stepdad. And he was a drunk and a bit of an abuser, but he thought that was a good idea. She didn't. She didn't want the guy in her, living in her bedroom, but Dad thought it was a good idea, encouraged the guy to move right on in. Another girl, she was 16, still in school. Her parents confronted her one night about the fact they thought, suspected she was gay. The reason they thought she was gay is because here you are, you're 16, you're still in school, and you're not pregnant. What's going on? True story. So they're understanding what's even true. What are the values for what's true that is being imparted to them is, when you're in the populations, you know what I'm talking about, but if you're just dabbling in it, you don't really realize. You sit down and talk with some of these kids sometime. Ask them about their understanding of moral truths, biblical truths. They're at a deficit you just can't believe. And they're being taught quite the opposite. And so there's major issues here. Dominant culture, relational capital. Ruby Payne talked about this, where she talked about the unwritten rules of society. The unwritten rules of society are typically written by the dominant culture, right? The at-risk kids you're working with are very shrewd and very effective at navigating the culture they come from. So don't ever assume that this is an indication that they're not sharp, because it's not. What it's an indication of is they've been taught a culture that's a subculture. And that what the values and mores of the subculture clash with the values and mores of dominant culture, which is why they get fired, why they can't hold a job, why they get in trouble, why they get thrown out of this, and why they get thrown out of that, is because they're acting in ways consistent with what they've been taught are the necessary things to be effective in society. And the opposite is happening every time they go out of their little subculture and go try to go into the broader dominant culture. Is that making sense? Okay. The mistake oftentimes is made that you just think, well, they're uneducated, or they haven't been taught, or, you know, not very smart, or, you know, not paying attention, or what's the problem with this kid? Well, the truth is if you went with them to their neighborhood, it wouldn't take very long at all before you'd hang on their shoulder saying, you know, can you keep me out of trouble? Because, you know how this, you know, neighborhood works, and I don't. And they do. Okay, so they have social capital. It's just minority culture social capital. Yeah. Sure. There's all kinds of cultural overlays. You're dead right. We as a church need to be, we need to think about it this way. This is the way I like to put it. In Acts 1:8, Jesus says, you know, you're to be my disciples in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. Well, think about who are those people? Who was Jerusalem or Judea or Samaria? Well, Jerusalem, that was the people that he was talking to. That was their friends and neighbors and family, people they knew, related to. They were just like them culturally. Judea, that's people that, well, they're not friends and neighbors, but they're the same culture, so if they bumped into each other at the supermarket, they'd be friends because, hey, you're like me and I'm like you, and we could be friends. Samaria, now that's the people that live right next door, but you don't want to be their friends. Matter of fact, you drive around their neighborhood because, you know, you wouldn't want to run into them in a dark alley, okay? And, of course, ends of the earth, those are people that are geographically distant. The subcultures in our city is the Samaritan population of that paradigm, if you will. And they have distinct cultures. And you're right, we can look at them, and they look just like us, but their culture is completely different from ours. And ours is not a superior culture. It is a dominant culture, and those are two concepts you have to understand. It is a dominant culture. I'm personally of the opinion, some people think that that's a sin. I'm personally of the opinion that there's always going to be one. No one's going to, whatever group sets the tone, the ones that aren't setting the tone are going to be upset about it. So I don't know that there's spiritual value in trying to change who has control of the dominant culture, but I do think that it behooves us as part of the dominant culture to sacrificially serve those who are in minority cultures and recognize that we're in a dominant culture. This is part of who we are. And we got to help these kids learn how to navigate dominant culture if they're going to be successful. They don't know the unwritten rules, and we don't help them. They'll keep bouncing off of it, and they do.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Real quick, too. Just piggybacking on what she said, I personally, me, I don't think it's effective to bring them in to what we consider to be a Christian culture. I think what helps and what's been helpful dealing with some of the populations we've dealt with is allow them to worship God in their own unique way. You know what I'm saying? Because we get in a group and we think how we worship God, we want them there, and they can't relate to that. So they say, oh, I can't relate to that. But when they develop a relationship with they have with the Lord, mm-hmm. then they'll create waves we never even knew existed
right.
that they can uplift God,
right.
and still he's being glorified.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I would agree wholeheartedly, though I would add that there obviously are some caveats as far as sometimes what people will go to would be extremes theologically or in teaching that we would want to put some curbs on. And there's some cultural things that get brought into the church in the subculture that are no better than the inappropriate things that get brought in by the dominant culture. So I agree with caveats, and I think we probably would agree on a lot of those.
I'm just thinking with this, too, one of the things is, yes, we've got a lot of inner cities youth, but one of the things that I've seen, especially in the last few years, is the number of immigrants,
mm-hmm.
too, and there mm-hmm. are a lot of teen immigrants
mm-hmm.
that have another subculture
right.
than ours.
Sure.
And so we've got more than one subculture that
exactly.
we can work
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. No yeah, question about
you
that.
You have to know the different ones because I've known Mexicans and I've known Somalians mm-hmm. and you know people
mm-hmm.
from the Muslim world. And they've got different ways of viewing things and different... You know, and each one of them has their own different way of looking at things, and so you have to approach them in different
absolutely. Well, I've kind of pounded that. I'm going to come back to a couple of these in the practical section and talk about how we do some of that. But notice, by the way, trust comes from the same group Greek word as love as faith does. Faith, trust, same word in Greek. So you got faith, hope, and love up here. Greatest of which is, of course, love. So the Bible seems to tell us what we find experientially, it's love relationships is the greatest thing. Those three are intertwined deeply. Kids don't trust, they lose hope, and they don't feel loved. That's a concoction for failure. And so we can learn how to, and we ought to know how to love people as the church. We ought to be able to learn how to build trust with people and cast hope because we bring hope. So there's some things we have to bring to the table. The last thing I want to add to this, again, this is an intermediate practical piece, what I call the growth curve on this. This is a phenomenon that I've become familiar with just through experience. I have two people on this curve here. Person A is a higher functioning person. Person B is an at-risk person. Along the bottom, we have the amount of time and effort that it takes to invest to produce change in that person. And over here, we have the level of functionality where we find them at. And it's kind of an inverted curve because what you find is that the more functional they are, the less time it takes to move them further up. Mm-hmm. And the less functional they are, the more time it takes to move them significantly less further up. And the challenge of working with at-risk folks is they tend to be down in this end of the curve. And the reason that's a challenge is... time and effort. There's another one.
Circumstances.
The resources.
It could be the circumstances to get the time. Could be limited resources, but it's not the one I'm driving at.
Environment?
Nope.
Takes longer to understand them.
That's all. These are true, but that's not the one I'm driving at. So I'll quit being coy here. It does take longer to see the change. If we get ego involved in our ministry, you want to be working with these kind of people. Because you can produce, you know, a gleaming disciple. Everybody say, hey, good job. You're doing some great work. Look at that stellar disciple that you have there. Okay, and you caught him right about here, and you worked with him for, you know, about that amount of time. And when you come down and work with these kind of folks, you put all this time in and you saw them go up just this little bit and you're like, this just is not worth it. And what drives that sometimes and not always, and it's a delicate, difficult process to discern the spiritual, but you got to guard your heart. Because if you get ego involved, if this is what God's called you to do, then you need to do it. And if it takes a lot longer for this person to change, you've got to have the ability to put them under grace. Because if you're looking over at your buddy and your buddy's discipling this guy over here and his guy's becoming stellar, he took 3 classes, he's on his way to being an elder, your guy just got off crack last week, okay? And you're spending 3 nights a week with your guy, he meets with his guy on a Saturday afternoon for their 1:30 to 2 o'clock appointment. His guy shows up with his homework done, his 3 books read, and with 5 questions. Your guy lost the book, didn't care about the homework, and his only question is, can we go out to eat, you know? And you start looking over, and the reality is, it's a real thing. The reality is, you're like, what am I doing? I want to be working with those kind of people. And the problem is that the church universal is moving towards working with those kind of people. But God calls us to go to Samaria too. And so we need to be in these populations. And what it takes is it takes the capacity to not take your identity from your ministry. That's what it takes. And I've said this several times in different ways in other seminars I've done, but that's, and I'm repeating it from last year, but that's a good way to explain it. You take your identity from your ministry, you won't stay very long because you'll bottom out. Yeah.
I appreciate your chart there. I have one question, though, and I don't mean to be pessimistic, but is there a point where you say it's not wise for me to spend a lot of time with this kid because
right. It's a great question. It's a great question, and that's where I say I think it takes a lot of wisdom and discernment to be prayerful about a question like that. I think you got to seek the Lord's heart. I don't think that we ever write anybody off. I will say, for example, in our ministry, Youth for Christ, one of the populations we work with here in Columbus is the kids in wheelchairs. We have kids that are mentally low-functioning, below level, where I think they can even understand the gospel. So while we may want to provide some social activities for them to be involved with, I'm not going to have my people spending a bunch of time talking with them about something they can't even comprehend. So definitely there's a point where, you know, mental functioning drops off and then, you know... But I don't have a clean line. And all I can say to you is that it's a real question and it's a big challenge. I think you got to seek God's face in prayer. I think that's the only answer to that. You got to really discern if your reason to pull back is because you feel like God's leading you to, or because you're just tired and you know God sent you on this journey and it's just too hard. One of the things I spent a lot of time on last year and I won't get too much this year is how working with these kind of folks changes us. And so I'm also going to suggest to you that the equation isn't just am I getting traction with my investment of time or not. There could be things God's trying to teach you during this window of your life that he'd be just happy for you to get pushed against a rock that doesn't move. And so you got to be real discerning as to why you're pulling out. But it's a great question. I wish I had a magical pill answer for you on that one. Yeah, you had a question.
I had the same question.
Same question. Okay, good. It's a great question. All right. I found that to be a really helpful thing to understand as you work with more at-risk kids. It's also helpful, by the way, when you think about it, as you start to see movement, it gives you hope because you know that if you got them moving, that movement will grow exponentially. So don't be discouraged. Yeah.
Hey, Scott, can I just add something to that last comment? I think another trick which requires great prayer and discernment is feeling so sorry for
absolutely.
And we could get in a mindset of, oh, I'm just loving this really hard person, and our ego is being fed by what a great job we're doing, not thinking this person, I could have really challenged them a lot to be a lot farther along than they are.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
I think it's a danger working with at-risk kids, or you can be so sympathetic that you think they end up not doing them much good.
It's here's a litmus test probably for me. It's pretty hard for me to be in a relationship with someone for 4 or 5 years or more when I haven't pushed them to a point where the entire relationship is on the line and they may just walk and give me the finger. If I'm not pushing them at least in a 3 or 4 year, 5 year window to step up hard enough on some issue that I'm not sure whether they're just going to not walk, then I'm probably not pushing them very hard. I agree. It's a great point. It's a great point. And that's just kind of a rule of thumb for me, just because it's worked out that way. You know, if you're in there loving them, there does come a point where you need to kick them in the behind and say, enough's enough. Yeah.
Tom Stipe made a good point in the opening session that I think, you know, comes in here when he talked about having a level of godly indifference and, you know, under the Holy Spirit's direction. You know, mm-hmm. People are resisting, then just shake the dust off and go where they're, you know, our folk
right.
God has been working on their heart.
Yes. It's a great point, but then again, it takes discernment, because what is the difference between resisting and just being slow in responding that's somewhat affected by environmental factors? You know, those are hard issues. Yeah.
I think the key way of understanding that is interest. I mean, I'll never write a kid off if he's interested in hanging out with me. Even if this relationship is kind of slow moving for whatever reason, if he's interested, man, that's a huge step in the right direction. That's some kids that aren't interested. And, you know, my time spent is better at going after someone who's interested. I'm going to be able to put the invite to other kids. But I'm not going to put all my effort in trying to get a kid to come hang out with me when I've got one who is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, for me, that's the, like you said, litmus test. That's my litmus test. That, for many years, I went after kids that, come on, I'll hang out with them, hang out, they wouldn't do it. But I've got this other kid right next to me who's, hey, sure, I'll come hang out.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to do ministry with someone that's not present.
Right.
so I work with mostly, like, the kids that are really, really high functioning. And then I think part of the struggle that I've had is when, like, we also get a number of kids that are really at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've struggled with just personally is really maintaining a vision for, like, what could God make these students? They've got everything against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can clearly see, like, these kids that have had tons of spiritual investment their entire life. I have a vision for what God could do in their life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get a vision for a kid that you're working with that seems to
mm-hmm.
be hopeless?
It's a great question. It's what I would call a faith vision. I look at what I think they're gifted at, and I look at what anybody else that I know that's high function, it's gifted that way, what God uses them for, and I'm like, that kid can be just like that, even though I can't see it. By faith, I believe God can use this kid to be just like that, and that's the vision I cast for that kid. No matter what the circumstantial variables that would suggest that he'll never achieve at that level, I refuse to believe that. So it's just a faith choice based on their profile and, you know, their personality makeup and their gift set, as best as I can discern that. The other thing that I will look at too is that, and kids typically respond to this pretty well, is that the damage and brokenness of their life gives them a capacity to minister to others who are in the same kind of circumstances. And you can always cast a vision for that. You know, you may have been molested, but God can use you to help other girls that have gone through what you're going through or have gone through, you know. And amazingly, the people that are most broken and in pain latch to that vision. You mean, God could use me to help someone that's gone through what I'm going through? I want that. And so that's another thing that I'll look to. Those would be probably my two off-the-cuff responses.
Cool.
Yeah.
Just one scripture. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5, he says, we no longer consider any man according to the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's
great.
Working with all people, you started with great.
Right. Great quote. Yeah. Sure. Absolutely. You know what? I tell you what. I would love to take questions, but I'm running out of time, and I got a couple things I want to get covered and get really down into practical here. Some practical suggestions. Okay, I'm going to repeat myself a gazillion times. Always the number one all-time root problem, love relationships. Again, if you heard nothing else today, walk away with that. However, here's some things that have been helpful to me through the years. Again, I've given these in your handout, so you shouldn't have to copy them. Unless the point's too small. Time together, length of time and patience in the relationship. So time together, on a weekly basis, but also how long you've been hanging out together, 6 months, a year, 2 years. Time, nothing can replace time in relationship building and helping them feel loved. Help them learn about God's love and grace, not just your love and grace. And that's going to be something that's going to bounce off of them. But as another guy that I know that's been real effective with at-risk kids talks, but he talked about inoculating kids. You keep saying it, even though it looks like you're pouring, you know, water into a sponge and it just disappears and you never see it again and you think, I'm not making any difference. You just keep by faith pouring it in. God loves you too. Help them understand about grace. It is possible. We have urban kids with some of the most horrible backgrounds. They get grace. Takes them a while, but they can get it. So I don't believe it's at all that it's not possible for them to understand that. Be transparent with them and coach them to be transparent with you. They won't be transparent if you're not transparent with them. And you know what? Broken kids and at-risk kids are the number one sniffers of BS of any kid you're going to work with. Okay? Don't come in there trying to get them to be honest and transparent with you if you're not willing to be. Matter of fact, you're being counterproductive at that point. Because at that point, they're going to look at you and, pardon my French, but you're full of shit. You want me to do this and you won't. You cannot tell them to do it, not do it yourself. You got to lead by example. That's how they're going to get that. So you have to be transparent. I can't emphasize that enough. Listen for and discover their relational pain. Great question, very practical. Tell me your story. That's all you have to ask a kid. Tell me your story. What do you mean? Well, you know, what's life like from your perspective? What was it like growing up being you? Don't engage them in anything else. Just wait. And they'll start talking, and most kids will still be talking an hour later. They want somebody that cares about their story. Ask questions about relational pain. You want to take an out-of-control, crazy, zooey group of middle school kids from the city or from the detention center and have them be instantly quiet. Say, today we're going to talk about the effect of all the pain that's going on in our lives at home and what it feels like to have your dad leave. Just ask and say, that's what we're going to do, and you can hear a pin drop in the room. I've done it several times. It's amazing. They live through their pain. That is where they're living. So listen for it and discover it, because they're aching for somebody to care. And that will give you huge leverage. They will feel loved if you care about their pain. Well, that's just important. Both functional and emotional love. They need you to be both there for them, and they need you to put your arm around them appropriately and hug them. They need both. I'm the be there for them kind of guy that has a hard time putting my arm around them and being emotional. That's who I am. I got a guy in my home group. It's almost like a walrus. He just all over everybody. You know? But sometimes he's not there for them. And we can go to either extreme. And so we got to realize it's a both and. Figure out which end of that you're on. You got to push the other way. And the more the at-risk issue is, again, the more this emotional issue is an important one. Celebrate special events. Get to know their family. Be willing to take risks for them. Teach them how to drive. A lot of kids I know, their parents will not teach them how to drive. Their parents will not do this for them or that for them. Things that you would just expect. Well, every parent does that for their kid. No, not every parent does. And while it may be inconvenient, and you might, why am I doing this? I co-signed a loan for a girl to get a car. Bad idea. Because she had a job and she couldn't get to work, and her parents wouldn't help her out. Sorry, we won't do that for you. Be willing to take risks for them. Yeah, you know, she was not that good at paying her bills, so I took a little hit on my credit. I survived. But you know what? She's trying to serve Christ in Christian work today. So it made a difference. You know, it does make a difference. Be willing to be inconvenienced for them, drive them places. A story just this last week, kid, second to last day of school. Long story, but his parents have been living in a hotel, rotating around, mom and stepdad. And he got so sick of moving every couple days that he went and was living with aunt. And so they had to schlep him to school because he was outside the school district. He'd lost 20 days of school because of all the chaos. They had pulled him out and made him babysit his sister. And he's down to one day left. If he misses one more day of school, he flunks for the year. Second to last day of school, his dad shows up to pick him up at his aunt's house. His dad will only wait 3 minutes. If he's not out in the car in 3 minutes, he leaves. His dad leaves him, strands him. Second to last day of school, knowing that if he's late to school or if he misses school, he flunks an entire year of school. Our staff person went over at 7 in the morning on her vacation and picked him up and schlepped him to school. Well, that kid will remember her doing that the rest of his life. You know. Teach them their family relationships to God and others. This is kind of an awkward way to say it, but most at-risk kids, if the relationship is the issue, there's huge power in the metaphor of family. Notice in the story at the beginning, she talked about a family group. At our club, we break into what we call family groups. These are groups of kids that we try to build together in community, and we call them family groups. And you know what? They love to be quasi-adopted by you. I'm your aunt or your uncle or, you know, I'm your second dad. Don't ever try to take the position of their first parent. Huge mistake. It'll blow up on you, guaranteed. But being the second parent, being, you know, the informal relative kind of a relationship, makes them feel loved. It communicates that you're part of me. And I'm committed to you in ways, and it's a powerful thing. One thing that I used to do with, I did this with some kids that were in a detention home and then in a group home. So when they came to Christ, we would make an adoption certificate. You've been adopted into God's family and blah, 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 blah. And we signed it and the whole bit. Now, this kid framed it and put it on the wall of his room. It was the most important possession he had. A little adoption certificate said he had a dad. Family relationships, if you communicate through that metaphor, they get it. You do have to be careful that you're clearly communicating the difference between what a good dad is and maybe what their experience is, though, because that can also backfire on you if you're talking about dad and their only experience is an abusive dad. Okay? And then lastly, let them serve you. If it's a one-way relationship, it gets stale, and they don't feel love. They feel like they're your project. So try to find little ways it can be two-way. It makes them feel part of your life. All right, let me blow through some other. Build hope. This is the second thing. Pray, think, and talk about their gifting and how God can use them. That's what we were talking about earlier. You know, think about how could God use someone that's gifted like this? Cast vision for leadership roles in their area of gifting. You know, this can blow up on you, and we've had it blow up on us. But I'll tell you one thing. There's nothing more powerful than an at-risk kid getting a vision to be a leader. They will crawl through a bed of nails to become a leader. There's something powerful about that vision for them. Now, you got to be careful that you don't let their role get ahead of their character on that. So you got to create little steps towards being a leader. In our system, we've created a process where when a kid outgrows our programs, but he's not mature enough to really be a leader, we have this thing called a volunteer in training, which is essentially he's not really a leader. He's not really a volunteer, but he's no longer a kid, so he's a volunteer in training. What does that mean? I don't know, but it feels like a leadership role, and it's a step in between, and they feel like they've arrived. We make some little requirements they have to be in that group. And so those kids are, we had some issues with them, and we fired them all. They were living double lives on some things, and we just fired them all and made them reapply. They reapplied, and they're striving because they want to be used as a leader by God. And they repented of some of their issues. So casting a vision for leadership is really powerful. Spend more of your time looking forward than backward. This is really important. If you want to project hope and you spend all your time talking about how their life's messed up, it doesn't feel like you're pushing them forward. So spend more of your time looking forward. Point out changes in growth when you see it and praise them. I mean, that's a little obvious. Consider carefully how you critique and discipline. These kids are bruised reeds. So it's saying in Isaiah about Christ that, you know, a smoldering wick he wouldn't snuff out and a bruised reed he wouldn't break. People are like that. And the Messiah came to love people like that. And so there is this tension, and I think Todd brought it up, it's a good one, about we still need to kick them in the butt once in a while. But if you've invested deeply enough, you can do that without breaking them. And it's an art, but you got to be careful when you discipline them. One thing that I always try to do when I discipline a kid and I'm really in their face is I'm saying to them how much I love them and how much I believe in them and how much I see how God could use them to be a leader and how God could use them to be this. If only they would repent from this knuckleheaded thing they're doing, I want to just beat them over the head over, you know, something like that. And so there's this high confrontation and high love message mingled. If you do that, you can usually get away with it. Frequently, they'll walk out and say, I hate you and I'm never coming back again. And you say, yep, see you next week. And they come back. You know, they do. They always come back. If you love them, they'll always come back. It may take a couple weeks, but they'll always come back. Open doors for them and friends and create small steps towards success. One of the big losses of at-risk kids and urban kids is that they don't have networks of friends that open doors for them. Their parents don't open doors for them. We do that in suburban culture and with just the way we do. We think that everybody does that. No, they don't. Open doors for them. Introduce them to people who have succeeded from their background. That's really important. That casts vision. All right, and I'm running long here, so let me finish up. Be trustworthy. You want to build trust? Be trustworthy. You let them down, and that's going to happen sooner or later, but kids get it. If you're 99% trustworthy and once in a while you blow it, they get that. Okay. Understand their lack of trust. Get inside their head. Understand their pain. You'll figure it out. Why they don't trust people will be pretty obvious. Engage them on the value of relearning how to trust. A lot of kids think being not trusting anybody's a cool thing. I'm hard. I don't trust anybody. Well, is that such a good thing? Is it a virtue or vice to not trust people? That's a great conversation to get in with kids. Teach them how to forgive, which is one of the barriers to them learning how to trust again, is they got to forgive all the people they feel like screwed them over, and that's why they don't trust. Ask them to trust you. Here's a little metaphor. It's a good one. Distrust is like a king who builds a castle wall and a moat with no bridge or door. It's a great protection, but you eventually starve to death. And that's what they're doing. They're building these hedges of trust, but then they're starving to death relationally. Okay. Build a community. We could talk a lot about that, but we're out of time. I guess what I'm saying there, though, is try to keep it from being a one-on-one relationship. Build them into a community of peers and of other adults. Ideally, this is what the church should be. And finally, apply that holistic model. Think about it. We're still developing it, and you know, there's still lots of things. We're bringing years of experience around the table to try to sharpen this down. But even what I've got there for you, I think if you think about it and meditate on it, there's some things you can get out of that that would be helpful for you in knowing where to go and where not to go. And then lastly, and this is in your notes, just a couple suggested further readings. Scott Larson, I already mentioned him. He's with Straight Ahead Ministries. Elijah Anderson, this book, Code of the Streets, talks about the subculture of how this minority subculture and people working within that and how that's contrasted to dominant culture. It's a really great book if you want to understand that distinction. It's called The Code of the Streets, and then Ruby Payne, Framework for Understanding Poverty. So just a couple of suggestions. All right. We've blown through, and it's over time, so I'm going to stop there. Thank you all for coming. If you got some questions you want to talk to me afterwards, I'll be here for a while hanging out. But otherwise, thanks for being here.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.